Welcome to the People and Projects Podcast, where you'll find interviews and insights to help you deliver projects and lead teams. You can find us on the web at peopleandprojectspodcast.com. This is Andy Kaufman, President of the Institute for Leadership Excellence and Development Corporate. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the People and Projects Podcast. So let me guess, while you're listening to me right now, I'm guessing you're also doing something else, right? I mean, maybe driving a car or checking email, hopefully not at the same time, or maybe you're working out, or perhaps you're just checking out what's going on with your Facebook friends. And hey, you know, if you're doing that, hey, look up the People and Projects Podcast on Facebook and like us. Oh, sorry. I got a bit distracted there for a moment. You know what? There are seemingly an endless number of stimuli that are vying for your attention and my attention right now. So which do you focus on and why? You know, there are many great minds that are putting a huge amount of effort into these questions right now. For I could reasonably argue that time is no longer the scarcest resource. It's attention. And as we strive to focus in a world that's clamoring for our attention, I wanted to share one of my favorite books that's just coming out this week. It's entitled, Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn by Kathy N. Davidson. I had the opportunity to talk with Kathy earlier this month and look forward to sharing that discussion over the course of two episodes. Quick note for premium subscribers, your additional premium episode with additional insights from this topic will be published along with the second portion of my interview with Kathy. So let's get to that interview now with Kathy Davidson. Kathy N. Davidson served as Vice Provost for Interdisciplinary Studies at Duke University from 1998 until 2006, where she helped create the Program in Information Science and Information Studies, the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience, the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute, and many other programs. In 2002, she co-founded the Humanities, Arts, Science, and Technology Advanced Collaboratory, referred to as Haystack, a virtual network of innovators with over 6,500 members that directs the annual $2 million Haystack MacArthur Foundation Digital Media and Learning Competitions. In 2010, President Obama nominated Kathy to a six-year term on the National Council on the Humanities, a position confirmed by the Senate in July 2011. Kathy has published more than 20 books, including her most recent one entitled, Now You See It, How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn, which, by the way, Publishers Weekly has named one of the top 10 science books of the fall 2011 season. Kathy, congratulations on that, by the way, and thank you for joining us on the People and Projects Podcast.
I'm pretty proud. It's nice to be an English teacher that PW thinks is one of the top 10 science writers of the year. I like that a lot.
Absolutely. That's very cool. Now, Kathy, I have to tell you, just from the start, I have to say this, that I loved and hated your book. Now, I know hate is a strong word, but I loved it because it stretched me and it blew me away. And as I told you before we actually started recording, there are times I had to put it down and think about it because there are some assumptions that I'd begun to accept as truths, such as things like multitasking is bad or it's a myth. And of course, that's also, of course, why I hated the book, because it forced me to take a step back and get an honest look at some of these presuppositions that undergird things I teach and that I use with coaching clients. So your book is forcing me, if I allowed it here, to do what you and Alvin Toffler referred to as unlearning. So I just want to say thank you for writing the book, kinda.
I think that may be the highest praise. If I believe what I wrote, I would have to say that if you only loved the book, that maybe I wasn't pushing hard enough. And a little bit of that unlearning is really necessary. It doesn't have to be a bitter pill, but there has to be a little medicine in there, I think, if a book's going to be worthwhile.
Yeah, well said. You know, one of my favorite quotes when it comes to learning is from Eric Hoffer. You may be familiar with this, but he says, in times of profound change, and that's certainly what you're talking about, the learners inherit the earth, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists. So how does that relate?
Wonderful.
Yeah, how does that relate to today's educational system and workplaces?
Well, as you know, the theory of attention in the book is the theory of attention blindness, and that's basically the structuring principle of the human brain, that from infancy on, we learn what is important in our world to pay attention to, what our society, what our friends, what our teachers, what our parents, mostly parents, but everybody around us says is important. And to pay attention, that means you don't pay attention to something else. Now, basically what an expert is somebody who's spent a lot of their life learning to pay attention to one thing. And our whole model of education, actually from preschool all the way on to graduate school, changed a lot at the time of the Second Industrial Revolution, the 1890s, to focus on efficiency, productivity, and a kind of singular, single-minded attention, which I would call expertise. In other words, gathering lots of information about some small task or some small area that you could do as your job, often over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think that's true whether you're a college professor doing, you know, experiments on cell division, or if you're an assembly line worker. You know, we live in a century of highly specialized attention. Right. Now, what we know from attention blindness is that means you can be great at a subject and you might not even see other things that are happening around you. And I think too much of education, again, kindergarten to higher education, is focused on so much specificity that sometimes we miss the larger importance of what we do. And that, to me, is one of the biggest critiques of education. And I'm happy to talk about that as long as you want it on any level, because even the way we measure success in education.
They are multiple choice questions, right?
Yes. I mean, it's like all the world's knowledge is like A, B, C, or D. No. We know that when you live in the world, that's not how the world is divided up. It's a much more fluid, multiple, complex world than that.
Yeah, and even in the workplace, I appreciate your discussion about how, you know, there are people that are morning people, there are people, evening people. With the global nature of work now, the whole concept of what is a 9-to-5, what is a normal schedule, and clocking in and out, and maybe even the way cubicles are laid out, to the way we wire people up or don't. I was talking to somebody today, Kathy, who said they couldn't get on LinkedIn because their company blocks it, and it just made me giggle today, because I was thinking I'm going to talk to Kathy Davidson. And, so are we really going to put a wall up with these things and assume that people, what works in their private life isn't going to work in their public life?
I know. I talk about that with schools too, where kids are on their cell phones and they're on their media until they get to school, and they're all lively and excited. They're talking to their friends. Then they get to school and they line up and go into the school room, have all turned off. Yeah. And I think that's a metaphor. And then it's the end of school day and they get turned on again. I mean, shouldn't school be teaching you how to be a responsible citizen of the internet? Shouldn't the workplace be using this interconnected world to really rethink itself as an institution? And that's another one of the big, big things I want to emphasize is work and school are not like things that spring like pea pods from the earth. They're constructs. Yeah. We've learned a certain way of working. We've learned a certain kind of schooling, really only for about the last 150 years. Mm. But now we have a very changed world, and our institutions are based on a different world. They don't really support us in our endeavors in this very exciting and sometimes frustrating and sometimes even scary new world that we live in.
Well, I think I read it first in Robert Cialdini's work on influence, that we rely on shortcuts, so to speak. You know, these natural, or I think what I liked out of your book was sometimes these natural things are really just learned responses. But regardless, they help us sort through the chaos. Because like you said, there's all this chaos that goes on. Because if we had to take in everything and have to make fresh decisions every time we're confronted with this, it'd be tough, right? So if everyone else is screaming while running from a building, it's probably a pretty good idea if I do that as well, right? That's a good shortcut usually.
Yes, exactly. And that's the beauty of attention, of the way attention works. That, in other words, we pick up those clues around us and we use other people's shortcuts as what psychologists call scaffolding, on which we're able to make quick decisions. The negative is sometimes those quick decisions short circuit, not shortcuts, but our short circuiting our own judgment and emotions and values or experience. And so we do things quickly without skipping over too many steps, and we don't really think about the importance of of what we just zoom right on by. And, you know, we see that all the time. Some of the most depressing news we ever receive is when people don't stop and see somebody who's injured or in the midst of violence or something. And what's interesting is often when you're able to replay the scene, it's not that people are looking at the person who's subjected to violence and apathetically moving on. People don't even see it. It's like not in your worldview. You're rushing for a train. You've got something else on your mind. You don't even see what's happening that could be changing somebody's life in a horrific way right beside you, and you don't even see it. The other version of that is seeing people rush to work and in the background, and there's a wonderful history of photography along the genre of people with these stern faces rushing to work, and behind them will be like the most beautiful sunset you've ever seen, and they're not stopping to pay attention to it.
Right.
The same thing that makes us efficient makes us efficient, and that sometimes is a problem.
Yeah, and you know what? I can't help but think, as we're recording this, a lot of the discussion about the debt ceiling is still going on. And it reminds me on politics sometimes, if someone is socially conservative, anything that somebody on the left says is crazy, and someone, if they're on the left, whatever to the right says is crazy, there's like these shortcuts even there. I'm not actually going to think about it, because sometimes what they're saying isn't even that different. And yet we're looking at through different lenses. And what I find is, when I'm looking through these lenses, I can see it in other people sometimes, but I have trouble seeing it myself. And what I love about your writing in this book about this selective attention, right? Most of the times it works for us, let's say.
Yes.
But you've got this approach, or it seems to me almost like a core value of collaboration by difference. So
yes.
Would you explain kind of how that works and how it helps?
Sure. There's all kinds of studies of collaboration that say people always say they want collaborators who are very different than themselves. If you talk to any work recruiter, they will tell you that everybody says, now I don't want to just mirror myself. I want someone really original. And then when they make their selection process, they hire someone just like themselves.
Yeah.
There have been so many studies to show that.
Yeah.
What the organization that I co-founded, Haystack, likes to do is very purposely construct situations where we put together teams where people have either remarkably different backgrounds, insanely different ages, really different cognitive abilities. We've worked sometimes with people who have Asperger's or other attention spectrum disorders, or most commonly really, really different kinds of expertise, like the artist with the computer programmer with the business manager. But even in that situation where you set up people to be in really with different talents, unless you structure to reward their diversity, it never happens. So one thing that I do is I call it a clock, which is I have people tag what their strength is. Like someone will write C++ coder. Somebody else will write sound artist. Somebody else will write narrative teller. And somebody else will write business manager.
Right.
And I have them put that on a card and then hand the card and work in groups of four and then hand the card to the person next to them and set them a challenge where they have to perform on the task that's on the card rather than from their own expertise. And then first we flounder around for about 10 minutes, and believe me, the bank, like the accounting person, doesn't necessarily do so well with C++. But then I have them work in teams with somebody who also is not the expert in what they're doing. And then the third step is to fold in the expert. But before the expert can do any work on the project, they have to do an evaluation of the work done by the non-experts. And I've done this now, I would say, maybe 20 times.
Yeah.
The response almost always is for the expert, the first phrase out of their, maybe you can guess, the first phrase out of the expert's mouth always is, I never would have thought of that.
Right.
That's where innovation and creativity come from. When you have the expert learn something they never would have thought, then, you know, we might even have to throw out all the work that was done before, because it might be, you know, building a bridge that's going to collapse is not such a good thing.
Right,
but that the expert has been made to see in a way they've never thought of before is one of those moments you prize as a teacher, as a parent, as a CEO, as an entrepreneur. It's something priceless. It's absolutely priceless.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Because coming out of the 20th century, there was still the kind of the superhero mentality, right?
Right.
So too often it's just, I'm going to do it myself. And I think over time we learned the wisdom of at least make N greater than one, right? So at least there's somebody else other than you. But I like this pushing of not only in addition to you, but different from you.
Right.
And that they're going to see it differently. I can even imagine when I might be facilitating a meeting of saying, listen, I'm going to be so focused on making sure we're progressing through here. I'm going to have to... You, please, keep an eye on the body language. You keep an eye on the, you know,
that's
so
right.
They're looking
you got
for something different. Yeah.
Yep, that's exactly right. Because if you don't do that, people will watch you watching them, and they won't see what's happening. If you say to somebody, your job is to watch body language, or your job is to watch who's bored and when they're bored, or, you know, it makes a huge difference, especially if you have a mechanism where they get to check in. Like if every 15 minutes a timer goes off and you say, oh, body language timer, what's going on? I'm not seeing here.
That's right.
You know, it's, and I often use timers because first of all, they're deep. They're really deep in our psychology because as kids, we're used to alarms going off, school bells, all these things that keep us on time. So they call us to attention in a different way. Yeah. They also allow you to take a big breath and say, okay, we finished that segment. Now let's look at what we've done. And people just psychologically gives them a chance to sort of make a big sigh and then look at something from a different point of view. So I'll often say when I'm talking to a group or when I'm working with a group, I'm going to set the timer for 5 minutes. And then the timer goes off. People are often shocked that 5 minutes has gone by. And it also teaches them the value of time and the value of their time and other people's time in an interesting way.
Yeah, that's good.
Make sure to check out the links in the show notes for more about Kathy, her organization, her book, and her blog. Join me in the follow-up interview when Kathy and I talk about how technology is changing how we stay focused. It's a great discussion. Well, thank you for joining me for this episode of the People and Projects Podcast. Have yourself a great weekend.